You're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on the Mies Network. Mies is the chef-created recipe operating system that makes your professional kitchen life easier with unprecedented tools for recording, scaling, analyzing, costing, and teaching recipes, much of it at the press of a virtual button. Learn more at getmies.com/Andrew. That's GETMEEZ.com/Andrew.
This episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs is supported in part by San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For the past 125 years, San Pellegrino has supported the art of fine dining in all of its ever-changing forms and nurtured the next generation of chefs through resources and mentorship. To learn more, visit sanpellegrino.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
No, I was very happy when the chef took the limelight. What I wasn't happy was when they didn't listen to me. The title of the book is I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. Guess what, Andrew? They were the difficult ones. And in so many cases, when you work with exceptional talent, they gotta leave because you get 3 stars in a restaurant and it's like, is that your 3 stars? Or is that the restaurant's 3 stars? Like Michelin, the chef leaves and it's almost like automatically you're going to lose the stars. That shouldn't be the case.
That is the voice of legendary restaurateur Drew Napourant, author of the recently published memoir, I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. Drew is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the
senses to make some sense of this. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. I hope all of you out there are doing as well as possible today. Our guest on this episode is the great Drew Napourant. Drew is one of the most important restaurateurs of his or any generation. And he is out with a new memoir titled, I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. More about Drew and the book in just a moment. On the dining front, I'd love to shout out a restaurant that I ate at just before Thanksgiving. And that is 53. 53 is the Alta Maria Group's upscale Chinese restaurant on West 53rd Street, where I had dinner last week. It was only my second visit to the restaurant. I ate there right around the time they first opened, and I was really happy to see that it was absolutely packed and also that the food and service remained top notch. I recommend going with a big group if you go so that you can try as much food as possible. I actually did not go with a big group. I only went with one other person, and that was because I was having dinner for the first time with somebody some of you out there may be familiar with, which is why I'm mentioning it. But I had dinner with Ray Harris, who I met quite spontaneously several weeks ago at Francie in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And if you don't know his name, Ray is one of a very rare breed. He is a famous restaurant guest. He was known for years as the most devoted fan of Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. I believe he had something like 400 dinners there. He actually appears in and also helped produce the documentary Love Charlie that came out a few years ago and is very good. I recommend you watch it. Anyway, Ray, if you're listening, thank you again for dinner. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And finally, I would like to put in another word for the cookbook collection I've been mentioning here recently that is available at Kitchen Arts and Letters Bookshop in New York. It is a collection put together by Chef Mark Forgione to raise funds for City Meals on Wheels, an organization that provides meals to homebound elderly New Yorkers. And it is an organization of which I joined the board last year. There's a link where you can check out the program on the episode page for today's show at andrewtalkstochefs.com or wherever you listen to your podcast. If you're looking for a gift for yourself or for cookbook collectors in your life, I think this is a pretty cool program. I gave all the details just yesterday on another episode, so I won't belabor it here, but please go check it out and help support City Meals on Wheels. A quick note of thanks here to one of our promotional partners, San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For the past 125 years, San Pellegrino has supported the art of fine dining in all of its ever-changing forms and nurtured the next generation of chefs through resources and mentorship. To learn more, visit sanpellegrino.com. So our guest today really doesn't need an introduction, does he? I don't think so. Drew Naporant is one of the restaurateurs who quite literally helped shape the world that we all enjoy eating in today. He first made his name at Montrachet in Tribeca in New York City, which later became Cortone, and then the restaurant became, or that space became, the home of Batard. He also was the driving force behind the foundation of the Nobu restaurants, and he has owned and operated such restaurants as Tribeca Grill in New York City and Rubicon in San Francisco. He is, of course, out, as you may have heard, with a memoir this fall. It is titled, I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. It's quite enjoyable, which is no surprise because Drew is one of the industry's great raconteurs and storytellers. The conversation I'm about to share took place over lunch at Nobu downtown earlier this fall. And I have to say, I usually try to like really tighten up these conversations and omit all kinds of extraneous dialogue and moments where people are thinking, et cetera, et cetera. I left most of that in this time because I just love the feeling I think is captured in this interview of being at the table for just a rap session between two people kicking around a bunch of subjects. We get into all kinds of things from critics to owner-chef relationships. Sorry for the siren in the background. I am in New York City. To the state of the industry. And I had a great time talking to Drew, as I always do, and I think you will enjoy it quite a bit. For those of you on the younger side out there, we do mention quite a few names from the past. I know a lot of you look to this show to become familiar with people like that. I tried to, as much as possible, briefly interject quick thumbnail sketches of people and places that come up. So hopefully that'll keep you oriented throughout. And I also have to publicly apologize to Drew's collaborator on the book, Jamie Feldmahr. I usually make a point of mentioning collaborators in interviews, but Drew and I got off on so many tangents that I lost track of that and failed to do it. But Jamie was Drew's collaborator, and Drew has rightly been very public in acknowledging her role in writing the book, and I just wanted to do that here at the top of the show before we get to the conversation with Drew, since it doesn't come up there. Before launching the interview, I do need to ask, as we do here, have you checked out Mies yet? Mies, of course, is our presenting sponsor, and it is the recipe operating system for culinary professionals. What that means is that if you work with recipes in the pro kitchen or bar, Mies was designed for you. It is a place to virtually house your recipes, and it enables you to derive all kinds of information from them, from nutrition and allergen data, for example. It also allows you to scale them up or down and even to cost your recipes out, and you can do most of that at the press of a virtual button. The basic version of Mies is free for the entire culinary industry. Store and organize your recipes with the most advanced recipe scaling technology on the planet. Upgrade to premium and let Mies make your entire business more efficient and centralized. Train and onboard team members, manage production, and even process invoices. And as a listener to Andrew Talks to Chefs, receive 25 free recipe uploads and breakdowns on your new Mies account by signing up today. Learn more at getmies, that is getmeez.com/Andrew. You can head there on your own if you can remember what I just read you, or you can just look for the link in the episode description for today's show at andrewtalkstochefs.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you do go by memory, please do not forget the /Andrew at the end. That is the only way that they will know that we sent you there. And with that, here is my conversation with Drew Napourant. Here you go.
Good to be here, Andrew. Thank you.
It's great to be here. We are in a, what do we call this, a semi-private dining room?
We're trying to absorb as much noise because Nova is a busy restaurant. I think we'll be all right as long as we speak loud.
So we are at what is properly referred to as Nobu Downtown.
Right. This is the new Nobu.
Right. This is not the original Tribeca location that a lot of people who have been in New York or haven't visited in a while may know.
Tribeca was 22 years, and then we opened 5 days later here. And we haven't missed a beat. This is a beautiful place. David Rockwell did do an amazing job. It's probably the most decorated basement of any restaurant that I know of. Scary what we spent many years ago at this moment. So...
yeah.
But it's doing great. Thank God.
It's beautiful.
And thank God.
And as we speak today, I don't know if we're talking between bites or biting between
we're
talking,
talk,
but
then,
we're having lunch.
We'll have lunch. You know what I mean? This is the dish, yellowtail jalapeno that everyone orders because it's the dish that basically launched 1,000 Nobus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the dish. I've probably eaten this dish. Well, I've never not come to a Nobu and not had this dish.
Wow.
So that's important. That's an important dish.
So, Drew, we're here to talk about your book.
Thank you.
It's a book that a lot of people, including myself, have been waiting for a long time.
Right.
You are you might be the most celebrated raconteur in the industry. I don't know if I know another one.
Listen, I appreciate everything you say. I think the one great thing about the restaurant business is there is a place for all of us. And I don't know if I say it in the book, but I love music. I was going to be in the music business. I found it so cutthroat. Fashion, so cutthroat. Movies, so cutthroat. And you know, you and I were both at Daniel Boulud's birthday party, which wasn't his birthday, but it was a great, amazing party. And what you saw really after so many years is the camaraderie, the friendship. And it's not phony. I mean, some people are phony, of course, but I think restaurants want everyone to be, you know, to uplift everyone. They help each other. So we're in the charity Meals on Wheels together. Tremendous. So, you know, I'm celebrated. Why? I opened 40 restaurants in 40 years. That's an amazing achievement. But guess what? John Joy's has probably opened 60 or more. And Danielle is easily, you know, approaching higher level. I don't think it's a question of how many restaurants you have. I think it's a question of how long the restaurants last. Mine lasted a long time. And Tribeca was 35 years. Mm-hmm. Nobu is now 31 years. Even Rubicon in San Francisco was 15 years. Montrachet, my first restaurant, 37 plus years. So, well, Montrachet morphed.
Not as Montrachet.
No, morphed into Cortone and then morphed into Batard.
Right. Okay. Why finally, at this moment in time, or 2 years or three, I guess you were first thinking about finally doing this maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
You mean the book?
Finally doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why now? What I mean, it's been sitting there for you to do forever. Why did you just? You're still very active as a restaurateur. You haven't retired. Maybe you never will. But why this moment in time?
Look, I'm not. When people say, "What are you going to do when you retire?" I say, "I'll read a book." I mean, I have no problem in not working. There's just something about hitting 70 that's extremely humbling. You know, I've been through some health issues with my. Cardiomyopathy, you know, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So I had a stroke a couple of years ago. The same year, actually, I had kidney cancer. I lost the kidney. So I think it's just a timely thing. I've been partners in my restaurants with very famous actors, i.e. Robert De Niro and Bill Murray, Sean Penn, Mikhail Baryshnikov.
The late Robin Williams.
Robin Williams, Francis Coppola. And I never thought about a book. I always thought cinematically, but you realize that you either need a screenplay or a book So it made sense to write the book. I didn't know how it was going to come about, but so far, prior to its release, it's really humbling because everyone's wishes are very genuine.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah,
that's
I mean, good. For what it's worth, that's what I hear.
That's really
that's what
nice.
I hear when you're not around. People
okay.
seem to be enjoying.
I'm glad
it.
To hear that.
But and I guess I should probably say I have. I think I said it to you on the phone last. But I enjoyed it. I learned some things. You know, I've known you. I don't even know
each other a long time.
I don't know if you remember this. You were the first person of note in the industry that remembered me.
Oh wow!
And when I was a PR guy. I worked for a guy named David Kratz, who you'll remember.
I loved him. He was great.
And we're still friends. He lives in Brooklyn. And at the time, David had like the restaurant PR firm in New York.
Of course.
And I went to an event honoring Nick Valenti, who at the time was running Restaurant Associates. And we repped them, so we bought a table.
Nice.
And I had met you once. And I went up to you. And in those days, I always used to reintroduce myself because I assumed nobody knew right. who the hell I was. And I went up to you and I said, Drew, and I before I could say it, you go, I know you're Andrew Friedman. I know you work for David Kratz.
Oh, nice.
And I couldn't believe it.
Well, I'm very happy about that.
So that was
the mind doesn't work necessarily that well these days. So I appreciate you telling me that. But look, I had a wonderful mother.
Yeah.
She was an actress, a child actress, actually. And my father worked for the State Liquor Authority. And my father was the one. You know, one day we're at the office. He worked not far from here, actually, on Chambers Street. Liquor Authority had their offices there. And we were young kids. We were, my brother and I. And he's taking us around. He goes, he sees this lady. He says, fellas, this is the most beautiful woman in the office. I mean, she was ghastly looking, but he's paying her a compliment. Not 5 minutes later, this is the most beautiful woman in the office. So after he did this to three different women, and we were very impressionable, I look at my father and I go, Pop, what are you talking about? They're ghastly. Which one is the most beautiful one in the office? And he goes like this. He goes, you know, son, it never hurts to give people a compliment. But, you know, he was genuine in his way, but he was full of shit, you know.
Right.
About that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I took so many lessons from my father because he was so warm and so loving. And I believe that. I mean, it's like, you know, I've read other people's memoirs and they're nasty as crap to people. So, you know, but I don't have any issues with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Even David Boulay, who was my chef at Montmartre, famously, and I had a breakup, you know, and we made amends over the years. So it's like, you know.
Right. So
that's what's important.
So I learned some stuff about you that I for all the and we've interviewed many times. You right. gave me a huge interview for my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Love that book.
We interviewed during COVID for this show.
Right.
But there was stuff I did not know about you. One is
like what I worked at McDonald's.
Well, no, I did not know that. Although maybe you told me and I forgot it. But I don't think you told me that. That was interesting. But no, there's two things. Well, three things about what I would say is your psychology that I got in this book that I would say were hardwired into you at a young age. One is you have, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm not wrong, I just want you to comment on it. You have a very deeply ingrained and motivating sense of right and wrong.
Oh, my God.
Injustice. Really pisses you. What you perceive as injustice.
We're going to have to get together more often because that's 100. That defines me.
That is something from childhood.
Unbelievable.
Imparted to you by one or both of your parents.
Well, definitely my parents. But, yeah. You know, growing up with Robert Kennedy getting assassinated, Martin Luther King getting assassinated. I was like 12 and 13. Black people were treated miserably. And like what you just stated is it was that's 100. I mean, I used to go to grade school, went to public schools in New York City. And, you know, we were integrated, but there were very few black people. So I befriended, you know, certain black people, took them home.
How'd that go?
Cook
over?
For them.
How'd
great.
That,
great.
It was fine. Okay.
You know, I mean, my mother found cigarettes on the windowsill. Because we would smoke and try to, you know, get rid of the evidence. But I, you know, in my own little way, that's what formed me. And it forms me about everything I do. And which doesn't necessarily mean I'm right all the time. But when I see, you know, how it works, especially in this day and age with this idiot, you know, and we're all supposed to be like, I mean, it's almost unbelievable how much we're losing.
Mm-hmm.
But my father ingrained it in me. It doesn't hurt to be nice.
Yeah. Well, this to me is a very motivating. I mean, this 100%. That was something I learned in the book.
Yeah.
Now, this is a delicate question.
Sure.
And if you want, we don't have to answer it. I'll take it out of the interview. You know, I know I'm not the only one. I've always perceived you as someone who really holds on to anger or grudges for a long time. You know, there are people who I've seen you sometimes and I'll mention a name and you'll refer to something that happened 25 years ago. But reading the book, I was like, oh, maybe it's not so much. Thank you.
What's Tiradito fluke?
Okay. The one thing I can't eat is scallops. That's the one.
Oh, no, there won't be any scallops. Okay. But this is fluke with yuzu.
Cool.
That's
beautiful.
The second most important dish in Nobu.
Okay.
And then you might be eating the third most important dish also. So.
But here's what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Have I had it all wrong? I always thought you took stuff super personally, but I was reading this book and I'm like, maybe he's just outraged.
Well,
at something that maybe other people wouldn't, but something you perceived as just, like I told you, we don't have to say what it was, but you mentioned going to an event and I just said to you, I wasn't invited. And you're like, how does that happen?
Yeah, yeah.
Like you seemed more annoyed than I was.
Yeah, no, because, well, first of all, you just before the way you define, you know, my thinking about a lot of things. So when I see an injustice, or I see something being handled improperly, you know, I kind of feel the need to step in. Like small diversion, James Beard Awards. For years, Peter Kump, when he was alive, you know, we'd do the James Beard. Tribeca would be like an alternative kitchen for Jean-Louis Paladin, Michel Richard, countless chefs. Even Emerald did a dinner. James Beard Award, they come to me and they said, you're going to be really happy. This is years ago. I said, why? We have a Restaurateur of the Year award. Oh my God, incredible. Okay, so the first year, who's nominated? Danny Meyer, Rich Melman, Piero Salvaggio, Druna Porent. Who wins? Danny Meyer. Okay, he's the guy. Second year, who's nominated? Rich Melman, Piero Salvaggio, Druna Porent. Daniel Boulud. Who wins? Daniel Boulud. Third year, blah, 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 blah. Thomas Keller. Who wins? Thomas Keller. Fourth year, blah, 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 blah. Mario Batali. Now I'm fucking pissed off. It's a chef's award. You throw the dog a bone, one restaurateur award, and you put chefs in the restaurateur category. So that's an example of getting pissed. Now they hear me, you know, because I'm not quiet about it. And they go, you can't be a chef. For, I don't know, they put some many years on it to win the Restaurateur Year of the War. And, of course, I won that year. Guess what? Who won last year?
Oh, I don't know.
No.
And I was there.
I was in the room.
I know.
But I watched it. Frenchette. Last time I looked, they were both chefs.
Yeah.
So the point is, yeah, when something's wrong, it's wrong. And I think there are certain people who've contributed more than their fair share to the industry. They're part of the community. So when you see them at an event versus seeing some freeloader who's just going to this event to eat, that's what outrages me. And that it does.
But can I just ask you,
yeah,
the whole award thing?
Yeah.
It took me a while to realize this, but you know, you're a perfect example, okay?
Okay.
Because of all the stuff you've achieved.
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, to me, awards are always going to be popularity and politics. They're going to be some combination of those things. And there are great people in your industry who have never won awards.
Right.
They're oftentimes because they don't have a PR company. They don't play the game.
Okay.
They don't do the events.
Okay.
Right.
That's all fair.
Right.
All fair.
I do believe sometimes you get punished the way Spielberg did in Hollywood for years, right, for being too successful. For example, we're sitting in one of your Nobu restaurants. For the longest time, tell me if I'm mistaken, even though Nobu was eligible after 10 years for the Outstanding Restaurant Award,
Well, Nobu surpasses Susan Lucci.
Right.
He was nominated for Best Chef.
He was.
A million times.
But the restaurant...
The restaurant won Best New Restaurant
in 95. But that was before it had all the success.
Right. Well, Best New Restaurant.
Right. But I'll give you a comp.
Yeah.
Kraft.
Yeah.
Now, it may have happened since then, but for the longest time, Kraft never got that nomination, right?
Right.
And I was talking to Tom once, and I said, I think it's you get punished for... I call it the Spielberg effect. But if you go to... If you look at Hollywood, I mean, Alfred Hitchcock never won an Oscar.
That's crazy.
I just rewatched the movie Zodiac, the David Fincher film, which not even a costume design, zero nominations.
Wow. I love Michael
Mann's Heat.
That was amazing.
Nothing.
Robert De Niro and Pacino.
Nothing. Nothing.
All right,
so at some point, I just thought, you know what? Who cares?
No. I get the who cares, and you just...
Like to give it that much power.
No, but you laid it out
very
well.
Because I could get upset every year having never been nominated for a Beard Award, and I just don't...
Okay, you've never been nominated for a Beard Award.
Nope.
Guess what I found out? And I love the guy. But at some point, the Journalism Awards, you have to submit your work.
Yes.
And pay for it.
Yes.
Pay for the submission.
Yes.
So Alan Richman has like 12 James Beard Awards. I never knew that. Now, we won a Journalism Award for the movie... You know, A Matter of Taste. And I'll tell you that story off the microphones, who I was at the table with. Now, let me answer this question because it does matter. Until it doesn't. You articulated it beautifully. I couldn't have done it better myself, especially the PR part, because I never, ever hired a PR company until my book.
Right.
And they're doing a good job.
It's a good move.
They put me in touch with you, right? So anyway,
that wasn't necessary,
I know. And when I tell them it's not necessary, they get crazy. Okay, so I watch the Academy Awards with my mother, who is an actress, every year for as many years as she was alive. And the James Beard, for better or for worse, has always been referred to as the, you know, our Oscars. Why? It's the only awards we get, at least up to that moment. Okay? So here it is. It's very simple. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. Because whether you're number one in Zagat, or you're 3 stars in the New York Times, or you're a James Beard Award winner, nominee, whatever, and you can find problems with each of these entities for many, many reasons. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, because when you win one, you love it.
Of course.
Now, what's happened to the Beard Awards, it's almost unrecognizable. I mean, so Danny Meyer's got 30 of them. I have maybe 5. I don't know. They don't even invite us. Remember the invitation you didn't get for that event? So this year I'm watching the streaming. And who's giving out the most prestigious awards? Daniel Boulud and Danny Meyer. So they're learning a little bit.
The foundation?
Yes.
Getting people back into the fold.
You know what? Watching the James Beard Awards for almost, could have been as many as 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You watch movies. You know who the actors are. Okay? And if you were watching the Oscars, and whoever's getting the awards, you've never, ever heard of the movie. You never, ever heard of the actors. I mean, that's insane. When Charlie Mitchell wins for Clover or whatever it's called, Hill, I think he was like the only person, his name I recognized. So, I mean, you know, on one hand, the James Beard Awards, yeah, so what? Who cares? You know, you're not nominated. It's unfair. Okay. I mean, I'm not saying I played to that audience, but I sure as hell wasn't going to bite the hand. You know, when we were happy.
I know it's good for business, you know, which I respect.
Yeah.
But I still disagree. You know what upsets me?
What's that?
Like somebody, an actor, you know, I have a lot of entertainment stuff in my social media feeds, right? So someone will mention, you know, a movie and then like all the comments are like, oh, they should have, like a lot of the first comments, such a good actor and should have won an Oscar, right? But like, what does that mean in the context of the work? You know what I mean? That's what I mean. I think the fact that there are people who do great work, oftentimes maybe the best work, they're not in the club, you know, and they may not get recognized, even nominated. And that becomes, as hurtful to them as it is helpful and awesome for someone who wins an award. Like I have every year that I have some friends who like, you know, are upset they didn't get a nomination, you know, chefs and or writers. And I always tell them like this show I've never submitted for a beer.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you should.
No.
Can I tell you something?
Because if I don't get nominated.
Oh, you'll get pissed.
No, then it's just like, I'm like, oh, I stuck my, you know, I walked into that one.
But when you say, if I don't get nominated, you submit.
You right, pay but that's for the not submission. A nomination.
No, but they don't nominate people who don't pay for the submission.
No, I understand that. But I'm just saying, I've just never, you know, if I have a book, the publisher pays to submit. And if I were to win one, it would be great for sales. And I never have asked a publisher not to do that because they paid me to write the book.
Right.
But my own stuff, I don't do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I just abstain. But I don't have a restaurant to promote.
Every time the James Beard Awards came, we religiously went. And when we were nominated, we bought 50 tickets.
Nice.
So it was good for business. Now they don't even invite us.
Okay. Another thing that I always kind of knew that you, well, first of all, some of the waiter jobs you had early, front dining room jobs early right. in your career, right. you know, you were kind of half a cook, right? Because there was some tableside stuff that happened. And right. You talk in the book about the old Russian service you had to learn and your time on the
ships.
Cruise ships.
Yeah,
right. And you may not remember this, but years ago, I wrote a piece about you for Eater. And I said that you had never ceded the spotlight to chefs. You promote your chefs.
Right.
But that you were a very unusual restaurateur and that you, I think, were as well known as chefs and that you, in this age, right? And that you, you've done it in this conversation. A lot of the times when you talk about your generation in the industry, you group yourselves with Danielle, Jean-Georges, right? You rarely group right. yourself with the other owner-operators. Right. But here's my question.
Yeah.
And actually, I think this is something that's not really in the book, but this is how I felt this way for years.
Okay.
I think it probably applies most poignantly to Michael McCarty, because I don't think he's really gotten his due. I don't think he's known in the way that you're known. It may be in L.A., but nationally, I don't think so, but I think he was a brilliant restaurateur. I'm wondering if you felt a little bit like the world had bait and switched you a little bit, because you enjoy the spotlight clearly,
right?
And when you set your sights on the industry, it was still an owner's world. The owner impresario, that's who was known. That's often who the restaurants were named for. That's who the staff knew. You know, I interviewed someone for Chef's Drugs, who worked at United Artists back in the 70s,
right.
and used to go to lunch once a week with Mike Medavoy at Ma Maison, which not is where bad. Wolfgang started.
Yeah, of course.
And I said, what were your impressions of Wolfgang? And she said, we didn't know there was a Wolfgang. We all knew Patrick Tarai.
Patrick Tarai.
Yeah, who was the owner, who was on the, right? So my question for you is, were you caught off guard by that sea change that happened? Like right around the time you opened Montrachet, I feel like there was a lot of tension around that moment.
No. I understand what you just said. Here's what I'm going to explain. In 1982, I opened a restaurant called 24 Fifth Avenue yep. for Bruce Lewin. My chef was Leslie Revson. I put her name on the menu. He came to me. He goes, what's her name doing on the menu? I said, it's like a movie. You know, she's the star. She's your chef.
Yeah.
You want to promote her. I did the same thing with Boulay. I firmly believe that, you know, like some chefs now take it to an extreme, like, you know, the memories of home, wear headphones and let the sea come in as you're eating a scallop or something, you know, it's like, but I want people to know there's a human being who has characteristics and that's what's evidenced in the
yes.
food that you get.
Right. If the restaurant is a gallery, this is the artist being displayed.
Right. The only thing I gave a hoot about was I wanted it to be the director-actor collaboration. That you give the actor all the range that they want. You don't tell the actor, don't do it that way. You do it the way you want. But maybe you would consider a stuffed cabbage or, you know, things that I love because I know people that would translate well for people in the restaurant. So I wasn't competing. I think when you're in the front of the house, Cirio Marchionne is like the example.
This is the former impresario owner of Le Cirque.
Le Cirque. And barely spoke English, by the way. You know, like he spoke very haltingly.
But he understood it fine.
He understood everything.
His accent was intense.
But the point I'm making, he was the ringmaster. He set everything up. And actually having a star chef in his kitchen, Daniel Boulud, was his undoing. Because he could never replicate, although he tried, after Daniel, that success. In my case, I replicated. I won't necessarily say I went up from David Boulay, because David Boulay was terrific. But each one of the people, whether it's Paul Liebrandt, Marcus Glocker, Tracy Desjardins, Deborah Ponczek, Michelle Nishana, you know.
Harold Moore.
Harold Moore's doing great now. They all were on their own, very easy to promote. And in some cases, you know, some had less tableside manner, so the customer maybe didn't know who they were or care who they were. But no, I was very happy when the chef took the limelight. What I wasn't happy was when they didn't listen to me. The title of the book is I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. Guess what, Andrew? They were the difficult ones. I'm not trying to be difficult the way I read my book, because I did the audio also. The audio is very good because I read it. The way I read it is like, they thought I was being difficult, but I wasn't. They were the difficult ones. And in so many cases, when you work with exceptional talent, they got to leave. Because you get 3 stars in a restaurant and it's like, then it becomes a tug of war. Is that your 3 stars or is that the restaurant's 3 stars? Like Michelin. I mean, the chef leaves and it's almost like automatically you're gonna lose the stars. That shouldn't be the case. So, you know, my career was a little bit about a kill or be killed. In other words, if a chef walked out, the next day in the next week in the New York Times, you read chefs left. That's like a death notice. So instead, it was like, no, I replaced them with somebody, you know. And in most cases, there have been exceptions, but in most cases, because I know talent, and I'm not deluding myself. There are a lot of restaurateurs out there. Yeah, they can go to a headhunter and they can get a resume. By the way, I worked for Warner LeRoy. That's all he did. We had the chef from the Knorr Hotel. We had the chef from Commander's Palace. We had all these high-flying chefs. And guess what? Some were alcoholics. Some were drug addicts. Some couldn't even cook, for crying out loud. So that wasn't my way of building a restaurant. My way of building a restaurant was like finding the talent. How did I find David Boulay? Totally fortuitous. When it was in San Francisco. You know, it was cooking at an obscure restaurant.
You didn't even go for dinner.
No, I went for lunch. Actually. It was a lunch, which I prefer, by the way. But anyway, and you know, Tracy Desjardins worked for me as a sous chef at Montrachet. I never know who Deborah Ponczek was. And I could go on and on. So, but for me, having now where I am at 70, the chef is the most important thing. However, you know, there were journalists who, like, a chef can't open a second restaurant, can't open another restaurant. Why? Oh, because they had to be tethered to their stove like Andre Soldner. No, that's not fair. The greatest thing Paul Bocuse ever said was when asked by a journalist, you know, who does the cooking when you're not there? The same people as when I am there. But there is an extent. The restaurateur does have an advantage over the chef. Because guess what? The public imagery is, wait a minute. I'm seeing pictures of him on a golf course. I'm seeing pictures of him fly fishing. Why isn't he cooking my meal tonight? That's the imagery. Like, it's a different world now, Andrew. You know that. It's a different world now.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and thank God the chefs are able to promote themselves and be prominent. I mean, John George never stops. I heard he's opening a restaurant under a manhole cover. Guess who else never stops? Nobu Matsuisa. At the beginning, it was like, I have this restaurant in Beverly Hills. He said no to us. You read the book. He said no. Now there's 56. So it's like, I don't ever question somebody wanting to make a living. I just don't.
Yeah, I'm the same.
What I do question is the proof's in the pudding. If I go to a restaurant from a prominent chef, and this is not the case, by the way, but if I do have a bad meal or a less than good meal, because I never want to have a bad meal. I work hard never having a bad meal. And by the way, that's always been my philosophy also, which is the customer orchestrates their own good time in a restaurant. I believe that. But if something slips because they are doing all these places, and it could be in the front house, maybe not even the food, that has to be looked at. That's why I come here. I want, and the standards are kept up. Otherwise, the other day I went and I had a dish was oversauced. I'm not afraid to mention that to the chef. When I used to mention it to the chef in 1994, they looked at me cross-eyed. You know, you're not the chef. It's yeah. Nobu Matsuiza.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know food. That's yeah. why. That's why I'm involved.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, if I go to a friend's restaurant and something's, you know, amiss, I will, if they're a friend, I will, you know, well, text them or call them the next day.
That is
and,
tricky.
And, but, you know, if I'm with friends who are not in the industry, because right. once in a while I'll say, Kate will turn to me and say, you gotta text so-and-so. And if we're with friends who aren't in the industry, they go, you're going to say something? And I go, well, who do you think they'd rather hear it from, me or the New York Times? You know, I consider that an act of friendship.
Guess what?
I know some people will, like, take offense at that, but that's their problem.
Well, most people will take offense at that. But you're the line of first defense. You should be letting them know because you're right.
It's not a complaint. I always say I'm not complaining. No. I'm telling you this.
You have to be very careful because when somebody cooks something, they are taking it personally. Like how could it be? You know, what does that need salt? We know some of the chefs. You know, the arrogance of some of our colleagues are. They want vegetables. I'm not going to give them vegetables. I mean, it is what it is. But I think people are learning. We used to say, treat the customer like we want to be treated. No, treat the customer better than we want to be treated.
Yeah.
I didn't even think that way. But now I think that way.
Yeah. I have a weird question for you.
Go ahead.
You alluded to turning 70.
Yeah.
That means you were born in 1955.
Right.
This is kind of amazing. You share that birth year with Danielle.
Right.
You share that birth year with Thomas Keller. I believe you share it with Alfred Portale. I think.
If not, maybe 1 year.
Maybe 1 year. You share that birth year with Michael LaMonaco.
Really?
Yes. Well. So here's my question. Whether or not it was that year or a year before, whatever. That's kind of a huge coincidence, I think, for people, so many people at the top of an industry to be born not just around the same time, but the same year. Now, you're a philosophical guy.
Right.
Do you make anything of that?
Yes. Number one, all the people you mentioned, they're good at what they do. I mean, they're like phenomenal. They've been through some wars. They survived the wars. They've stayed true to the cuisine. They're not womanizers. They're not alcoholics. They're not drug addicted. Okay? And every day, I believe every day, every single person you just mentioned, every day, wants to learn something new. And I see it.
Well, these are people who are still very vital in the, you know,
right.
operating multiple restaurants, in some cases, dozens of them. Out and about all the time.
You know what freaks me out, though? Okay. As much as I'm happy for them, where is the next generation of chefs? And I can name a dozen. Absolutely. As qualified as those people that you mentioned. But those people still have, you know, the grasp of the top tier. And the other people are second tier. Nobody has overcome Eric Ripair, John George, Daniel Boulud. It doesn't, you know, you could say that I could name a dozen people right off the top of my head that have had great careers, but nobody has their career.
Well,
it's going to happen soon. It's got to.
But there are people who are heading in that direction.
Well, that's what I just said.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I think that I think the world that you all created is now overpopulated.
Really?
Professionally.
Okay.
Yeah, I think most of the big cities in this country have too many restaurants.
Okay.
And that's why we see closings, so many closings of quality places after like 2 years, 3 years.
Okay.
And there's less loyalty among the dining public, I think.
Well, that's true.
And, you know, I will never forget it when Jeremiah and Fabian opened Contra down on Orchard Street,
right,
which got a lot of attention.
A lot.
And are great guys. I interviewed them when I used to have my blog before I did this show. And it was the year that all these restaurants were turning 30, right? Or, you know, places that opened in 84, 85, right? So like Montrachet, Gotham, Union Square, right? All these places.
Right.
And I said to them, you know, there's all these places that are turning 30. Do you all aspire to something like that? And they said, it's different for us. They said, if we can run out a 10-year lease, we'll feel like we succeeded. And guess what? That restaurant, when the 10-year lease was up, that's when they...
Listen to me. You have terrific instincts for this industry. Why? I see people having 1, 2 year, 3 year anniversaries. That's not an accomplishment. I'm sorry. It's like,
no, but today it is. That's what I'm saying. No.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you.
But you guys also had way less competition for the limelight.
No, I don't know. I see that I don't agree with.
Oh, Drew, I have a list of like 30 places I need to visit. Were there 30 places you felt like you had to get to in New York City?
I swear to God, I have from 1987, 30 places that I've yet to visit. If you would come to my office, I kept track of every single review, whether it was Brian Miller, 9 years, Mimi Sheridan before him. The industry was flooded. I agree with this, what you're saying. The industry has evolved, so the food is so much better. And we have Brooklyn to thank for that. And we have, you know, the other outer boroughs. But we had a lot of competition. It was to become discovered. It wasn't like, you know, I set up in Tribeca. Nobody knew where the fuck that was.
No, I get that. But what I'm saying is this is the moment where it really crystallized for me.
Okay, go ahead.
I actually took a screen capture of it several years ago, probably pre-COVID.
Okay.
On Eater, okay? On the homepage for New York, there was a little, you know, they have the little tiles and you click through the article. And there was a tile that said something like, it may have been a bigger number, but it said like, you know, 25 restaurant openings this fall that you should know about, right? And then below it, it was 24 noteworthy closings.
Yeah,
there we go. Well, do the math, you know? There's a lot of people here, but there's not an infinite number of people going out to dinner every night. And I just feel like
that
something is going to give.
What you just said, that hasn't changed. There's too many fucking restaurants.
But you think it was that way when you started? That's what I'm saying.
Well, first of all, COVID, everything stopped.
No. I'm saying that when you started.
No. But what I'm trying to say is, yes. Yeah, there was too many restaurants. You forget, but this city was run by La Caravelle, Le Région,
yes.
La Reserve, yeah. Le Perigord. Look, everything was the Le La's. And everybody else was chopped liver. And then it was young Danny Meyer and maybe me and a few others that our generation, you asked, you know, 1955, when we turned 30, we got set loose. And we haven't stopped. I mean, Danny Meyer is fantastic. And Steven Starr is fantastic. I mean, it's unbelievable. These guys are amazing. And I took my inspiration years ago from Joe Baum, who was, you know, died in, I guess, in the, when he died in 98, I think.
I don't know the year, but something like that.
Joe Baum was extraordinary.
Tell people who that was, because that's a name most people, younger people, will not know.
Right.
But was kind of a major figure. You give him his due 100%.
Well, in my book, I went to Cornell. This guy graduated, I think, in 43 or something. Something ridiculous. He was the president of Restaurant Associates. opened literally dozens of restaurants, all kind of cool. Form of the 12 Caesars. Most notably, the Four Seasons in the 60s, which, you know, if you think of the concept, the Four Seasons, and they changed the plants, and they changed the uniforms on the waiters, and the food, and they, guess what? They wanted a 3-star New York Times review that wasn't a French restaurant. And they hired Albert Stockley, who was Swiss. And guess what?
That's the chef.
Yeah, they called it a French restaurant with Greg Klimov. Yeah, so.
But also they were, Jeremiah Tower loves to point this out.
Say it again? Oh, Jeremiah.
Jeremiah loves to point this out. Okay. Before it became, like a generation at least, before it became fashionable, they would identify the provenance of ingredients on the menu.
At the Four Seasons.
At the Four Seasons. You know, this thing of like so-and-so, whatever, Peconic Bay, whatever, or so-and-so farm, whatever. That, nobody was doing that.
100%.
Yeah.
Then Joe Baum, opened Windows on the World, by the way. Then Joe Baum opened Rainbow Room. And then guess what? He opened a French restaurant with a French chef. What was the name of the place? Aurora.
Oh.
Gerard Bengo. So everything goes full circle. But he was my mentor. So I fashioned myself after him. But truthfully, you know, restaurateurs, I mean, nobody, when I was doing it at the beginning, not even Danny. Danny had one restaurant for 10 years. Nobody was opening restaurants the way I did it. And I was fortunate.
What do you mean by that, the way you did it?
Well, in other words, I would get these calls. I want to do this, want to do that. I said, I'm sorry, I can't. I have one restaurant. Then I had two restaurants. I can't. And then I saw the people doing these projects. Some weren't full-blown restaurants. Some were just consultancies. But I saw these people, and I was like, these people don't know anything. Maybe I should do this. So I formed the Myriad Restaurant Group. And we did the Harley Davidson Cafe with Mark Packer. That, now you see, you know, They show the picture of the opening party with Epstein and Donald Trump. You know, they're showing that. You know, that, I did that, and I could tell you amazing stories. That doesn't even come in the book, by the way.
Right.
O.J. Simpson and his wife, you know, and O.J. was hitting on all the waitresses that night. That doesn't even come in the book.
Yeah, you held back in the book, Drew.
I held back. And I did. You're right.
You could have told. There's a lot of stories.
Like, ridiculous. And then... I just realized when I formed the Myriad Restaurant Group, Harry Macklow, we did the Macklow Hotel, nice guy. Jerry De La Femina did two restaurants out there. The story's in the book. I got punched. You know what I'm saying? That was a great story. I started doing things at a pace because I wanted to actualize my dreams, which was to do different restaurants. Now, guess what? I'm not a chef. I'm the front of the house. I'm the restaurateur. So I can hire the chefs. So they can't lay that guilt trip on me. Oh, you're spreading yourself too thin. But they tried. I always respected the journalists, even if I didn't agree with them. Why? Because when you read a journalist, you understand their likes and dislikes. And guess what? If you're a smart person and they don't like... a shrimp with iodine. I didn't even put shrimp on any menu of any restaurant I ever had. Mimi didn't like, she never met a shrimp without iodine.
Is that why you didn't let it go on the menu?
You know, yes. And you know the craziest thing? In the old days, some places it was just salads, but in the old days, you had these baseball bat pepper mills.
Yeah.
And they'd come over with the pepper mill. Like, that's good service. And I had one friend who was very close with Mimi Sheridan, Roger Martin, PR guy, great guy. And he'd yell at the waiter. The waiter would come over with the thing. How do I know? I haven't even tasted it yet. Why are you offering me pepper? You know, just to break balls. So the most important thing, Andrew, is as a restaurateur, you have to learn the basics, the lessons. You know, like I'll never forget, I was at a very prominent restaurant. And they go, it was a four top. And the guy comes over with the water pitcher. He was only able to pour three glasses because the water pitcher was too small.
Right.
That's not functional. Every single restaurant I've ever opened, I've never had one plate cover, never had one tray to bring out food. Why? That's the way we did it on the cruise ships. Why? That's the way we did it at Maxwell's Plum and Tavern on the Green. Why didn't I do it that way? Because in my head, I'm like, when food is cooked, it's hot and it's got to go out. And guess what? You'll never see a heat lamp in any of my restaurants, except maybe over here. Because when they listen to me, that's the way I did it. And in most cases, I was pretty good at what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not infallible. But.
What's the best chef relationship you had? Is there one?
You know, just like...
Is there one that was just like the honeymoon never ended? It was love all the way from start to finish.
Well, that's not... You see, you just defined it a different way. I've had very, very good relationships. And even now, I stay in touch with, you know, Stephen Lewandowski, who was my chef at Tribeca. I saw Don Pintabona the other day. We have...
That's our original Tribeca chef.
Yeah, our relationship was a little acrimonious. I loved Bitard and Marcus. He's the one who came to me, said, Keith McNally just offered me to cook at Augustine. Oh, I want to stay here, though. All right, well, decide. You know, you have a very good kitchen crew. And he stayed. I paid him a certain amount of money, and he stayed. Read Keith McNally's book. He acts like he doesn't even know that he's a chef stealer. I mean, you know, like, and I don't care. I don't. Chef stealing
used to be. I'm just reminding you, this is all going to be out in the world
good.
On my show.
Chef stealing used to be a big thing,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And
why don't you,
but it's when the people go through the industry, I don't care who they are, and they do something like that. And that's my compass. You understand? It's like this. You're dating a girl, okay? And you get a phone call, and it's a friend of yours. And he says, are you dating that girl? And you go, why? And he goes, well, if you're not dating her, I would like to date her. And you know what you do? Say, go ahead. And in your mind, you're thinking, well, she likes me. She's not going to date him. And guess what happens? She dates him. You know who told me this story the other day? Wolfgang Puck. This is Wolfgang Puck at Daniel's birthday. You know what he told me?
No.
He says, why aren't you wearing a jacket from Warner Loy? It was Warner was flamboyant. And I go, yeah, that's interesting. I said, I bet he tried to steal you. He goes, No, but he came to Spago, and he sees Mark Peel, and he goes right up to Mark
Peel. Oh, well, he did take him.
No, he goes right up to Mark Peel, and he goes, I'll double your salary. And it's like...
Well, people forget this. For 10 minutes, did you overlap there?
Where?
For 10 minutes, Mark Peel and Nancy Silverton came and were the chefs at Maxwell's Plum.
I wasn't there that's when they were there.
That's a forgotten moment in time. But they abandoned California very briefly.
Not forgotten for me, by the way.
Yeah. No, but historically, that is something that very few people remember.
100%. You know, and Nancy, I mean, God bless her. She's our age. She's older, I think. And she's like having a renaissance.
Unbelievable. Nancy Silverton, next time you see Nancy Silverton on Instagram, bear this in mind.
Yeah.
That woman was cooking professionally, not as the chef, but as a cook, in 1978.
Right.
No, she's unbelievable. She is a force.
You talked about Malcolm McCarty. They worked there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But you know, when you just gave that example of like, I don't want to chew while I'm talking.
Right.
But... when you gave the example of like the, are you dating that person? I'd like to date them. And you used the term chef stealer, which is a provocative term.
Right. But that's what they did.
But here's my question.
There's no other way to describe it.
But here's my question. Is it the stealing or is it the way they go about doing it? In other words, if a fellow restaurateur called you and said, hey, I want to offer so-and-so the job at my new restaurant. I'd like your blessing.
That's the way to do it.
Okay, but that's still taking your chef, right? So is it the etiquette? It's the etiquette.
I'll give you a best example I could give you.
I'm just trying to understand your view of all this. Because the likelihood is a chef who isn't a partner is going to move on at some point.
I don't have a problem with somebody moving on. There was one point in time where, and I love Michael White. He's a good guy.
Yeah, I remember. I was.
He took like two of my people. He took the pastry chef from Cortone. He took PJ Calipa, who's now the chef at. See how it works.
He took him.
Now he's the chef at Marea. Okay.
Yeah.
I said, they were interviewing me I think it was a Michelin party. And I said, and I'm going to stand by Michael White's kitchen door,
yeah,
and I'm going to hand out $100 bills to anybody who would come to work for me.
Yeah, this was with the late Josh Ozersky. This video is online still.
That's correct.
It was with Josh Ozersky at an event.
Josh
said something like, well, if they can afford to hire them, isn't that okay? And you said, that's why everyone hates the Yankees.
Yes.
That's what you said.
100%.
Yes, that's the interview.
That's good. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yes.
You're amazing. I'm getting more out of this interview than you're getting out of me. I love it.
But that was the interview, right? Because you had a big beef with Michael.
I don't have a beef with anybody. They steal my chef.
No, but you were very
I was
publicly
twisted.
Yeah, I know.
Twisted.
Yeah.
It's disrespectful. Okay.
Well, this brings the conversation full circle. This is your sense of moral outrage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen it. I don't know how this is possible. Maybe it's because my mother was a casting director after she was an actress, and that casting is finding the right role for the actor for the right role. I know how to cast, and you see it. Like when restaurants hire people, it's not going to work. Whether it's an ego thing, whether that person's not going to be content, not to make enough money, whatever it is.
So I got about an hour's worth of stuff. You want to keep talking, or do you need to start winding down for your next appointment?
No, next appointment.
I thought you said you had 90 minutes.
Don't worry. I'm not. You know, let's do one more question.
Okay.
I'm sure you have another question.
Is there no
sushi? You don't even have notes.
I wanted some sushi.
You know what's so funny? I'm giving you black cotton instead of sushi. Is that all right?
That's fine. No, I don't. I never bring notes.
That's amazing.
I prep. Okay. One last question. Let me think what I want it to be. Oh, okay. I got one for you. This isn't so much about the book.
Okay.
I'd love to know where your head is as far as, and I mean this very generically, but I will give an example. And I can make it more generic if you want me to. Several years ago, Momofuku Sambar got a 3-star review in the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember this?
Oh, 100%.
Can I use that name, that example, uh-huh, on the air?
Of course.
That's okay. Okay. I don't know why, but I saw you like the next day.
Right.
And you were, I'm going to say, borderline apoplectic.
Okay.
And it was, you cannot give 3 stars to a restaurant where the waiters are in t-shirts and there's no seat backs and your utensils are in a little container on your table. You're like, you can't do that.
No desserts. I don't. The first go round, it was not even desserts.
That I don't remember.
I don't think so.
And, you know, to me privately, I was like, well, that was really interesting to me because I think there were probably some old Frenchies in New York when you opened a place like Montrachet, who felt the same way about you.
100%.
And I'm just wondering, have you softened at all your view of what constitutes or can constitute a great restaurant today?
No.
you understand the question.
Yeah, here's what I'm going to explain.
Okay.
I think in order to get 3 stars, there has to be a 3-star aspiration. In other words, I don't want anybody to luck into 3 stars. Like, I just opened this place. I kind of want it to be a shit house, but if I get 3 stars, it's okay. And I could give you examples, by the way, off the microphone.
Okay.
I love David Chang. When he opened Momofuku.
The original noodle shop.
No. The
Sambar. Okay.
It was a Sam. And I went there and he had the world there. He had Martha Stewart. He had Tim Zagat. And I walked in. How's it work? I'm going to go over there and order your food. So I went over there and they gave me a burrito. I guess that's what a Sam was back then. It was a burrito. It's in his book. He writes about it. And
was this at lunch?
No. It was an opening party for
Momofuku. Okay.
No, opening party.
Okay.
But this is the way he was running it.
I'm asking because at lunch there, it used to be you went up and ordered.
No, well.
But at dinner, it was obviously
full service. Here's what happened.
But go ahead.
And it's good. I like David Chang a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very talented. You cannot dispute his talent. I left that place. I was like, this is going to fail. And then in his book, he agonizes over changing it. And then finally, he changes it at 9:30 at night. He does what he's successful at after 9:30. And then that's so successful. Then it's a little bit early, a little bit early. And guess what? The burrito goes. Okay, now he's entitled to get 3 stars. I'm not jealous of that, but listen to this. You'll like this. Cortone gets the call to fact check. Okay, we fact checked everything. Frank Bruni did not want to talk to Paul. He put
put this in the book. He wanted the answers in writing.
In writing, okay. Yeah. New York Times comes out the week before our review. Who's reviewed? Momofuku Sambar gets 3 stars. And I'm reading this, and you know what I said? Holy shit, we're going to get 4 stars.
Because the likelihood of them doing back-to-back reviews with the same rating was unlikely.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Now, I do not whatsoever begrudge a restaurant getting 3 stars, any restaurant. I don't care what it is. Even Una Pizzeria Napoletano got 2 stars. 2 stars when he was doing a collaboration with your friends from Contra. Had desserts. And then Pete Wells wrote the piece after they left and gave it. No, I'm sorry. The first review, he got 1 star when they were collaborating. And then they left and he gave it 2 stars after they had no dessert there. After they, how is that possible? You follow what I'm trying to say?
Then he gives two. I don't know that I don't entirely agree with you, but yes, I understand what you're saying.
No, you don't have to agree with it. I mean, obviously. But here's the point I'm trying to make. It's in the movie. The review comes out online. That was very unusual. In the afternoon, I go over to the filmmaker who happened to be in the restaurant. I go, let's film this. I haven't even read the review. Let's put this on camera. It'll be natural. So I'm reading the review and my staff is like, you know, listening. And then I finish the review and it says, but like 11 Madison Park, it falls just below
the highest.
Daniel, yeah. John George, blah, 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 blah. But there's no stars attached. So Paul's like, you know, are we there? No, and we, you know.
Because it was the online version.
Right.
Yeah.
But take that incident. 11 Madison said, oh my God, we're flirting with the higher tier. And that's what they set out to do. And guess what? They achieved it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an aspiration for 3 stars, guess who had an aspiration for 3 stars? Paul Liebrand at Guild. Guess who didn't get him? Paul Liebrand at Guild. Why? Because Frank Bruni, blah, 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 whatever. He's entitled to his opinion. In the movie, when he gives us the 3 stars, what did he say? It might not be the case, but it just seemed to me like he had simplified his cooking.
Yeah, well, the headline was something like creativity meet discipline or something like
you
that.
You have a great memory. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it was.
Yeah. You read reviews really well, by the way. I was at Gail Green's 80th birthday party.
That's
and
amazing.
You and I both did tributes. Mine kind of sucked. I was very nervous. But you read, I think, her first review of Montrachet.
Probably,
yeah. Yeah. And it was super. It was a cliffhanger the way you read it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, Gail, I said this the other day to somebody. We just never realized what a brilliant critic she was for a couple of reasons. But the most important reason, she didn't give stars. So I don't know if you've noticed, but lately there's about 50% of our population that must be drinking from dumb shit wells or something, because it is like, so Gail, they want to be led. My point is there's a populace out there that needs to be led. But Gail Green, beautiful writer, didn't give stars. People want to be led. They just want to look at the thing and say, oh, it's 2 stars, I'll go. 1 star, I'm not going to go. It's 3 stars, maybe I won't get in. Now, you know what motivates people to go? You can't get in. What is it called? Dorje? Mm-hmm. Dorje, you pay somebody to get you in. How much do you pay? I don't even understand the system. It's like, oh, you have to spend $300 a person or something. Who knows what the restaurant gets? That's really my point. New York Times, star system. It's so meaningless. They're not even reviewing New York restaurants.
Well, they are. One of them. There's was two the last times.
No, Minneapolis last week and San Francisco this week.
Last week was also Suns. Sonny Lee's Banchan place. I read it. That and was it, also last
also
week.
Also because it's online now also.
Yeah.
And every restaurant's got 7 tables.
I mean, the national thing, I don't know. All these papers are struggling for existence. I feel like that's maybe not the most... I think that's a defensible business decision.
Yeah, fine. I don't want to worry about your business. But I do want the Wall Street Journal to...
But I want to ask you something. When I get into these... Something I am very mindful of myself as I get a little older, and I constantly tell myself this, is things change. It's just the nature of things to change. I sense in you a resistance to that notion.
Oh, no.
No?
What, are you kidding me?
I don't know. I feel like some of these things...
My father. Change is painful, yet ever needful.
Okay.
I'll never forget that. Here's what I want you to ask me.
Yeah.
As a journalist.
Yes.
Why are you so obsessed? Why am I so obsessed with... You know, somebody writing about food. So ask me that question. Why am I so obsessed?
Why don't we just leave it the way we used to?
Okay, so here it is.
Answer it.
Here's the answer.
And then I won't feel dirty.
You have, not necessarily today, it's probably a good thing that it's changed, but you had enormous power. Mimi Sheridan, they call it the power that eats. And exercise correctly was informative.
Yes.
Once had an argument with Ruth Reichel. I don't write for you. I write for the people. Well, I'm one of the people, but okay, I accept what you just said. Here's all I give a shit about. This is all I care about. Get it right. Don't say it was Basil if it was, you know, another herb.
Right.
Don't say... There are certain journalists that get it so wrong. They're eating. It's something they're eating, and they can't even... write about what they're eating in a proper manner. And so for me, I want the journalist to be successful, to be prominent, to last years. But the only way they're going to do that is if they get it right. I love Pete Wells, but when Pete Wells goes after Thomas Keller at Per Se, and you know just the enormous care. And care is an important word in our industry, that Thomas takes in everything. That was just unfair. You know, so I mean.
Well, this is a whole other thing. But what really, and I have to say in full disclosure, for reasons I will never understand.
Right.
Pete Wells wrote a review of Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And it was a very personal and very nasty review.
I remember that.
And I wrote a piece for Salon about how pissed off and offended
I
was.
Yeah. I remember that. I do remember that.
And I don't apologize for doing it. I read it once in a while. I'm like, yeah, I feel okay about that. But he did something in that review with me, and I don't need to quote the exact line, that he did in that Per Se review, right? And this is what really got me. Like, let's say that was an intellectually honest thing that he did. What really burns me is when somebody is doing something like that,
right?
And in the midst of it, and the famous example is the bong water, you know, the mushroom soup.
That was nasty.
Okay, if you're writing a review that you must know is going to have an effect on the bottom line of a restaurant,
right?
That you must know is going to affect the people that work there. Where you must know that, you know, there's an old line about making movies that it's, right. Thank you, that it's just as hard to make a bad movie as it is to make a great movie.
100%.
Okay? 100%. And to me, you know, if people want to be snarky and writing about a television review, a movie review.
Snarky.
That if they want to be snarky and I don't like it, but you know what?
Yeah.
Those people don't have to go to work that day.
Right.
They finished that job a year ago.
I understand.
Okay. But restaurants. If you're doing something you know is going to cause financial and psychic pain, to make jokes while you're doing that, right. To me, is this brings us full circle again. It is a moral offense to me.
There you go.
I think it is a moral offense to people who are probably doing, maybe the owners aren't, maybe the owners got in for the wrong reason,
right.
But the people working there are probably doing their level best to deliver the best they can. Probably.
I agree.
Okay. And if you got, like Mimi Sheridan told me once that she considered criticism to be she said she was in the consumer advocacy business.
100%.
Right? That's should you or should you not go spend your money here?
Right. That's what they feel.
Okay. That's fine. If you feel like that about a particular restaurant, fine. If you're taking someone down 2 stars, don't be a dick about it. 100%. I'm sorry. You know, I don't know how else to say it. Just don't do that.
Right.
It's cruel. It is cruel.
I firmly believe Mimi didn't do it out of spite, you know, like didn't do it mean-spirited.
No, but I think she also is kind of almost like just the facts, you know, like she may say something wasn't good, but I don't think she was like a jerk about it. And, you know, Gail, for as much of a reputation she had, and as you and I both know, because we were friends with her,
right,
for being difficult and right, treating servers not so great, well, and all this
100%.
Stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
for all of that, you know what Gail rarely did? She rarely wrote a bad review.
Rarely she, wrote a bad review? Really? Yeah.
No, and we talked about it once. And
I think she rarely wrote a good review. No.
Well,
she wrote an in-between review almost all the time.
David Waltuck, who used to have Sean Terrell, your old business neighbor, he said all of her reviews were roller coasters, right? That's even a great review, there was going to be a peak and a valley.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But she once said to me, if a place is terrible, why do I need to waste? I'd rather be, you know, pointing people to stuff that I like, that I think they should know about. And the only reason I feel like I would need to write a negative review is if a place I feel has been wrongly praised. And then I feel like I need to go on the record.
Or she could have said, whatever Mimi Sheridan said, I disagree with.
Well, that's a whole other story.
No, because the critics review each other.
Yeah, sure.
And that's,
right,
that's, that was a problem at some point.
Yeah.
And look, I just didn't want to be, I've said it 100 times. I mean, I didn't want to read my obituary in the New York Times. So I needed to know when the critics were there. I wanted them to get it right. There was on one occasion where I felt that they sort of went past the ethics of how they tended to do things, and I pointed that out. But meanwhile, Mimi Sheridan, to her credit, she said, the critic will always have the last word. And I also understand that.
Well, that's that
so
old
you
line.
You can never win. You can never win.
Don't get. I mean, this is a line that goes more toward the, this is a pre-digital age line,
okay,
right? But
okay,
don't get into a fight with someone who's who buys ink by the gallon, right? You never heard that line?
Well, like, I do have a theory about getting into fights.
Okay.
I don't think people pick fights with somebody they're going to lose to. I think they only pick fights when they size you up and figure that they can beat you.
Well, this is the whole punching down thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're surprised when somebody who's, they size somebody up the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, Drew, I'm going to leave it there.
It has been enjoyable, and it went very quick, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We've been talking for a while.
The food was okay, but the conversation was scintillating. So,
congratulations on the book. And
I'm not trying to be difficult, and you're not trying to be difficult, I think. But there are some difficulties in our lifetime. So
once in a while,
it's okay to not try being difficult.
All right. Thanks, Drew.
Thank you, man.
And that is our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Drew Naporant for joining us. Go pick up his memoir, I'm Not Trying to Be Difficult. Links to where you can do that in the episode page for today's show. Please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @chefpodcast. And please go check out Mies, the recipe operating system for professionals, at getmies.com/Andrew. Thank you, as always, to Sam Pellegrino for their longstanding support of the pod. Andrew Talks to Chefs is produced by Table 12 Productions, Inc. The show is written, booked, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Andrew Friedman. If you would like to support us, we ask that you do that by telling a friend about the pod, posting about the show on social media, and rating and or reviewing us at Apple Podcasts. Our thanks, as always, to After School Special for our music. Please go check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, on iTunes. Again, please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @chefpodcast. And I thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here very soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.